From Given, this is Purposing, the podcast that lifts the lid on how to run a truly purpose-driven business. I'm Becky Willen, and with the help of leaders at some of the world's most recognized brands, I'll be demystifying this often misunderstood topic into clear, actionable advice you can use in your own business. This week, I'm joined by James Reid, Chair and CEO of Reid. James leads one of the UK's most recognisable family businesses and is the author of Karma Capitalism. So what does this idea actually look like in practice? And how does it stand up under current socioeconomic pressures and in a world of rapid technological change? In this conversation, you'll hear how philanthropy companies, Philcos, challenge conventional ownership structures and what that means for how businesses behave and succeed. Why James believes some ESG frameworks fall short of real change, and what effective execution looks like in practice. And as AI reshapes the world of work, what role does government policy and public funding have in the future of business? But before all that, let's explore the experiences that shaped James's worldview and what led him to believe that business has a responsibility that goes far beyond profit. James's story starts with a person who shaped his view of business more than anyone else.
So the greatest influence in my career was my dad, Alec Reid. He didn't go to university, left school at 16, struggled, but his mother sort of insisted he learn accounting at night school. He eventually succeeded in getting qualified. And he founded Reid in Hounslow in 1960. With £75 and built the business from the ground up, organically.
Growing up, James absorbed those early lessons about what it really takes to build something that lasts.
And he taught me that, you know, to grow a business organically, you need to have lots of ideas because you had to keep innovating if you're going to win new business. And you had to really look after your customers. And I remember him saying, you know, a company's like a vehicle and you can take it in any direction you choose.
Although James went on to Oxford and Harvard Business School, he's clear that formal education wasn't the most important teacher. And one piece of advice stayed with him, not because it gave answers, but because it made space for nuance.
And at the end of Harvard Business School, they said, you know, 50% of what you learn here will be wrong, and we don't know what 50% is. And I thought that's a brilliant piece of advice because it keeps you curious.
Eventually, James faced a decision about whether to join the family business. He wasn't sure, but what convinced him was a moment of characteristic directness from his father.
I was very worried, you know, being candid, that he was a tough act to follow. I was worried that I'd mess it up, fail, or be a sort of poor second shadow of him. And it took a bit of courage. He eventually said to me, you know, that job I've been talking to you about, James, it's going to be in the Sunday Times appointment section, which is where they advertise all the jobs on Sunday. Do you want it or not?
James said yes, and the lesson he took from that moment has stayed with him ever since.
One way of evaluating life is in the end, it's just a series of decisions. And that's absolutely true in business. But the good thing about making a decision is you can always make another one. And I observe this in young people, often lack the confidence to have a go or step up or go for that big promotion. Well, don't would be my message, because you don't know what your capacities are unless you have a go.
So James, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Becky. Thank you for the invitation. It's very nice to be with you.
So I think most people listening to this podcast are already sold on the idea that good business is good for business. But you're introducing a new idea into that mix. In your book, Karma Capitalism, you introduce the idea of a Philco. So let's start there. What is a Philco and why is it a better way of doing business?
What is a Philco? Well, that's a very good question. Philco is short for philanthropy company. And in the book, Karma Capitalism, we've settled on a definition, which is very simple. It's a company where at least 10% of the shares are held by a charity or charitable foundation. It can be more than 10%, but not less. So a company is either a philanthropy company, a Philco, or it's not. And it's not a new idea in the sense that, you know, there are many well-established, highly successful companies that fit that definition. many of which are featured in the book. I'm thinking of companies like IKEA, Rolex, Carlsberg, brilliant businesses, Patagonia, that fit that description. So the point of the book is to make more people aware what a brilliant business model this is and what positive consequences there are for society more widely through the philanthropic output that this model creates. So I would characterize a Philco as a different kind of business. It's a business with a different DNA to a regular business. And that sort of small change in DNA, rather like in nature, can really change the performance and the approach of the business, and it does, and it makes it a better business that does better and does more good work as a consequence.
But this isn't simply about giving money to charity, is it, James? Because the structural ownership part of this is really important.
No, it's a lot. It goes way beyond that, because you know any company and any individual can give money to charity. The Philco structure, the philanthropy company structure, changes the DNA of the business, and that's really important. It changes the makeup of the business. So, you know, Philco has to have at least 10% of the shares held by a charitable foundation. By any measure, 10% is a substantial block, and often it's much more than that. And when that occurs, the nature of the company changes. And it's not like a new CEO can suddenly decide, well, we're not doing that anymore. I mean, that's embedded. And the way the company works is quite different, because in our company, Reed, 20% of the shares, you know, more than now, are held by our charitable foundation, which means that everyone who works in the company works one day a week for charity. And it means that our customers know that when they spend money with our company, they know that some of that money is being recycled to good causes that might benefit their community, the society more widely, and the world that we live in. And that is very positive. And it means that more people care about the business. So when you hit tough times, people really double down and make sure that the business remains in good health and gets through it. And also, we're not interested in flipping the business. We're not interested in selling it in 5 years' time for a big return or piling in a lot of debt and taking all the cash and assets out, which is, you know, a model that's typically applied, you know, by private equity and in other companies. That's not going to happen around here. And people know that. And that's because of this structure.
And I think that's one of the, you've touched on one of the things that I'm really interested in, which is around how decisions get made within organizations. And I can imagine that if you have more than 10% of your shares held in trust charitable aims, then actually that does fundamentally change the way that decisions get made. I think one of the big criticisms of, I think you call it vulture capitalism in the book, is absolute kind of ruthless focus on short-term profit maximization at all costs. How does being a Philco change the way that decisions get made within organizations?
Well, I've been running Reed for as CEO for nearly 30 years now. So I've made lots of decisions. I could run this company very differently if I chose to. I would, you know, if I'd been parachuted in as a private equity CEO, I would be approaching this at their instruction very differently. And I would be able to make a lot of money for some people in the short term. And that's the key, the short term. But the substantive difference is that we make decisions for the long term. We're much more interested in longevity. We're much more interested in producing really strong long-term returns for all of our shareholders. And obviously the foundation is a substantial, well, it is in fact the largest of our shareholders. So I think it makes the thinking much more long-term and the decision-making more long-term. That's one aspect. The other is, I think we're much more tuned into people and people issues. When companies announce, you know, that they're going to cut their headcount by 40%, I mean, that hurts me just reading it. I mean, how do people in the organization feel about that? It might push the share price up on the stock exchange because the investors think, well, they make more money in the short term again. But that really harms the sort of culture of a company, I think. So we really try in recessions to keep the team together and to minimize the impact on people. So we've had to make redundancies. We've had to make difficult decisions around people because the most important thing is to keep the show on the road. But we try and minimize redundancies in recessions. And we have a operating principle that we will forego profits to ensure that we can keep our team together. So in a recession, we don't expect to make money. As long as we're not hemorrhaging money and putting the business at risk, we will do all we can to keep the team together.
Mm. Well, I like that. So it's both a sort of a business model, but also a mindset for organisations.
Yeah, it is for me. What I've observed, I mean, we became a Philco by accident back in the 1980s when Alec Reed, who founded our company, my dad, was taken ill with cancer and had to sell a business he had. He had a windfall of $5 million. He decided to give it to his charity because he thought that he might die and all the proceeds would be eaten up in tax and death duty and capital gains tax. So he gave it to his charity, and the charity then bought some shares in the business. So we became we're a sort of accidental Philco. But it's that journey since then, you know, we've got a 40-year history since then where the business has grown and improved and got stronger, that's made us realize this is a kind of superpower. You know, like in nature, our DNA kind of changed by accident, but thank goodness, because it's given us a real superpower. And I just want to make more people aware of this, because it's a brilliant business model. If you want to build a long-term business that makes a big impact and have a legacy for yourself, your family, or your wider team, because this is the way to go if you want to do that.
Now, I think you've been quite critical of ESG, and we'll come back to that in a minute. But one of the most important concepts in sustainability is materiality, which is really about how you identify and prioritize the issues that matter most to that organization, both in terms of company value, but also their impact on the world. And I guess the idea is that if you focus on what really matters, then you're able to have a positive impact on both performance and on society. I think one of the challenges that people might raise around Philcos is that you can be an organization that has a charitable foundation that gives, you know, quite significant amounts of money to that charity, perhaps is even has some shares owned by that organization, but still conducts itself really irresponsibly. You know, I'm thinking about the fact that most of the big tobacco companies in the world, you know, also have wealthy charitable foundations. So how do you address that within the Philco model? How do you make sure that this isn't a sort of smokescreen for irresponsible corporate behavior?
I think to become a Philco, someone or some people have to be supremely generous by giving shares to a foundation or charity. That's how all of these companies that are described in the book that are classified as Philcos, at some point this happened. So I can't think of any example of a Philco that meets our definition of at least 10% of the shares being held by a charity that's sort of gone rogue, as you might describe. Yeah, I mean, I a CEO could go rogue, I suppose, and sort of start pursuing sort of some ruthless agenda. It's sort of possible, but I don't know of any examples where that has happened, because I genuinely don't think that's in the makeup of them.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's like trying to make a Labrador into a Rottweiler. I mean, they're not the same DNA. I mean, they don't behave in the same way. So I think these companies that have the Philco DNA are genuinely, because of their makeup, much more likely to do good things. Now, those companies that you describe, there's lots of companies that give money.
Have their own charitable.
Yeah, I mean, there's an example, I think, in the book, Philip Morris gave $75 million to a charitable cause and then spent $100 million telling everyone about it. And you know, that's clearly not what we're talking about here. And you know, that fits into the sort of greenwashing, whitewashing, bluewashing problem that is widespread, I agree. But I think this model, in a sense, prevents that, because it's much more serious. So a lot of ESG initiatives, my issue with ESG initiatives is, you know, I've been on the wrong side of a lot of situations where we're bidding for business and we have to comply. We have to pay other organizations money to get on the sort of short list to qualify. And then, you know, we put in all this information, and our organization does a lot for the environment and through the Philco structure of a whole lot of charities. And then, you know, the people in the sort of procuring departments of these clients seem very interested in it during the bidding process and then never ask about it again. You know, seemed totally
loose. So it's a sort of bureaucratization of ESG.
Yeah, and then you look in these company accounts and there are hundreds of pages of very impenetrable words about things they're doing that are fulfilling various ESG targets. Yeah. So I think it's become a sort of, in a way, a bit of a fig leaf to cover up the sort of failure of companies to do more for society, because they're actually giving less relatively to charity than they did 15, 20 years ago. Since the whole ESG thing, I think companies often think, well, we're doing ESG, so maybe that's not so important now.
Well, I think that's an interesting distinction, because I think, you know, if you think about the goals of sustainability, which I think are broader than ESG, which was born out of the sort of investment industry, that is about how you make money in a way that also reduces negative impacts and create positive impact. I would always talk about the idea of profitably solving the problems of people and the planet. And I think when done well, sustainability is embedded in core business. It is part of how that business makes money in the first place. I think by creating that sort of distinction between how businesses make money and what they do with the money that they're making, as in give it to charity, I think is an interesting one, because I think many of the Philcos that you talk about in Karma Capitalism, Lego, Patagonia, IKEA, the impact that they have on society isn't just in the way that they work with charities and support causes. It's also about the fundamentals of how they make their money, how they run their business in the first place. So what do you think they're getting right when it comes to ESG? Because they're all three of those businesses are considered sustainability leaders, as well as Philcos, you know, in the way that you've defined them.
Well, they do amazing. I mean, they're very innovative companies that I would say are role models for all sorts of business leaders who want to learn how to succeed in business in the right way. I mean, IKEA has educated over 1 million children through its foundation, which is an incredible thing. I mean, you think this company sells flat pack furniture, but it's also done that. You know, the Novo Nordisk Foundation is, I think, the third largest, you know, foundation in the planet now in terms of giving to all sorts of areas of medical research that have made huge breakthroughs. I would say there's a sort of genuine interest in the sort of leadership and the ownership of these organizations in making a positive impact.
Yeah.
You know, that they're not just talking about it. Mm. They're genuinely looking for ways to do that. And I think it's really important to stress, in our business, Reed, our sort of purpose is just simply improving lives through work. That's what we're about. We're trying to help people progress in their jobs, progress in their careers, help companies find good people so that they can grow and flourish, and bringing people together in really positive ways. That is quite a simple thing. It's absolutely our focus. And I'm not sort of distracted from that focus by the fact that we're a Philco, because at the end of the year, if we've done well and there's a good dividend paid out to our shareholders, that then goes into the foundation. And it's the trustees of the foundation who decide how it's spent. Mm. Not me. I'm the sort of income department. And the trustees decide, well, we're going to put that into the big give as a match funding donation so it gets multiplied up. Or we're going to support this prize to help young people who are suffering anxiety and can't go into work, find new routes for them. Things like that. But the trustees decide that. That's separate from the business.
Yeah. But I guess that's what I love about the examples in the book, Lego, Patagonia, IKEA. Those are all organizations that do both. The way that they make their money in the first place is environmentally, socially positive.
Yes.
And the way that they then redistribute some of that money.
And why is that? I suspect it's to do with the founders or the founding families and what they cared about. So, you know, the people who set these companies up had very strong values.
And a strong sense of purpose.
They had a strong sense of purpose. They wanted to run their businesses in a sustainable and a proper way. And they also wanted to give back.
Yeah.
So that becomes a holistic approach.
Yeah.
It's not like you pick one and not the other. It doesn't feel that's how it works.
Yeah.
Because I genuinely can't think of a Philco that's gone rogue.
I love it. And I think what's interesting, you know, that actually these Philcos have been around for a long time.
Yeah,
you know,
incredible long time. I mean, our company reads 66 years old this year, and we're one of the newbies. I mean, that's why I talk about longevity, because several have been around nearly 200 years. And, you know, they're brilliant businesses now, highly competitive. They're not sort of archaic, you know, irrelevant structures. These are really dynamic businesses that lead their markets, which I think is really interesting because they've continued to innovate. They have that sort of in their DNA, I believe. I think in a sense, they've stayed true to their sort of entrepreneurial ethos. And, you know, when I say the sustainability and the Philco approaches typically go together, I think that comes right from the origin story. And, you know, there's a brilliant business, Raspberry Pi, that was floated in London a couple of years ago that makes affordable computers.
Yeah,
really brilliant. It's valued at over $1 billion. That was started by a charity that now has, I mean, their original goal was to make computers for kids that cost less than a textbook, which they succeeded in doing, which is, of course, a huge breakthrough for all sorts of people all over the world. And they run a brilliant business, and it's still, I think it's 40-something, 45% owned by the charitable trust that started it.
Yeah.
So that is a quoted Philco that's done really well and continues to, and it's really innovative.
Yeah.
So I think innovation is very much at the core of these companies. There's a desire to keep improving. Because if you know you're in business for the long run, as we do and wish to continue to be, I know that in 5, 10, 15 years' time, the way people recruit will be different.
Mm.
So I can't just sit on my laurels and carry on doing what we do. We have to innovate to be relevant in 5, 10 or 15 years. Otherwise, we're out of the game.
Yeah.
So there's a real sort of dynamic pressure around innovation that I think is interesting and important that helps us.
I guess on the topic of innovation, you can't make a podcast episode without talking about AI and the impact on work, on business, on society. Does being a Philco change how businesses think about AI? Should it change how businesses think about AI? And I guess particularly coming back to one of the things we were talking about earlier, the kind of mindset of really caring deeply about people.
I think, you know, AI is there to serve people, not the other way around. Yeah, I worry when I hear that it's going to strip organizations of thousands of people, that millions of people are going to lose their jobs. You begin to think, well, what's the point of it then? I mean, you know, the sort of, oh, everything's going to be much more productive, but no one's going to have a job. I mean, that's a terrible world that I do not wish to see. And because I think work is fundamental to our well-being. I mean, it gives people a sense of purpose and a real place in the world that without work, because we know this, we've worked with people who've been unemployed for long periods of time to help them get back into work, it makes us, you know, struggle. So I think AI is dangerous in some aspects because I think it can destroy lots of jobs. We've seen that already in the sort of graduate space. Our graduate vacancies in 2022-23, we had about 180,000 on our website. We're down at 50,000 in 25.
Wow.
So a huge drop in graduate jobs. That's been seen across the market. So it's much harder for young people now to get into work, and I think that should concern all of us. But I take quite a lot of hope from the fact that we are developing our own AI offer at Reed, but you need people to make it work really well. So we were just discussing having recruitment coaches who would help people use it, for instance. Well, that's a new job.
Yeah.
So I think there will be new job titles, new types of job that emerge as this technology becomes more embedded as well.
Yeah. So one of the things that you talk about a little bit in the book is the reason why Philcos are more relevant than ever being the decline of the role of the state in addressing important social, societal issues. And I guess that may be true, but government policy still shapes a huge amount of the business landscape. What kind of policy changes do you think the government should be putting in place that would support the Philco model specifically?
The book contains no suggestions for government, Becky, because every time I switch on the radio, people are asking the government for more money or to do something. And I just think we've got to a point where government can't do any more, really, not realistically. And when you look at sort of policies, so much doesn't work or isn't working well. And a key part of the thinking here is that businesses are actually pretty good at getting things done and delivering things. And if businesses stepped up and took more ownership of society's challenges and needs and became more widely, you know, supportive of a Philco model, a lot of these problems could be addressed independently of government. Yep. So that's the first point. But, you know, it's clear to me that some governments have been historically more supportive of this model than others. So the most extreme case is in the United States. You can't be a Philco. Charitable foundations are no longer allowed to have shares in corporations because of a change that happened back in the 1960s. I would urge anyone there who's interested to revisit that, because this model works really well outside of the United States and throws up a lot of benefits for society. In the UK, government could get behind it just by talking about it, by saying this is a good way for companies to operate, because the companies that are put together in this way do good work and they're good businesses. People like working in them, people like being customers of them. So government could get behind them for nothing just by supporting this as an idea, or an incoming government could. If they wanted to put incentives in place for companies to become Philcos, they could do that. I mean, one of the changes in the UK that has caused a lot of anxiety and worry amongst family businesses is the change in inheritance tax, where suddenly, you know, if a family member dies with a large shareholding, you've got to find 20% of the value of that shareholding to pay the tax. Well, a lot of families won't be able to do that very easily and might feel they have to sell their companies. What they could do, though, is just give the shares to a foundation, become a Philco, and fix that problem. So, you know, strangely, the current policy might encourage family companies to do that. But I think, you know, government should give more positive incentives for companies to do this, because, you know, it takes a lot of the heavy lifting off government if more companies... You know, our business is not a huge business. I mean, it's a big business, but not huge. And the money we throw off has helped raise hundreds of millions of pounds for charity through Big Give, the charity platform we support. And so we're just one business. If this was widely applied, it would make a massive difference. It's a simple idea that would make a massive difference.
So let's run with that for a moment. So if we were to fast forward 5 years and the Philco idea has really taken off, what would that look like?
Well, I mean, at the moment, we're seeking to create a group of companies who identify as Philcos. We've got a stamp that they can use. So we're trying to create a community of Philcos. I mean, it's a flotilla at the moment. I mean, I'd like it to become a fleet so that, you know, we have masses of companies doing this and we can support each other. But if that happened, so much more wealth that's created in society would be recycled back into society to positive ends. And at the moment, you know, it ends up in sort of bank accounts or in Monte Carlo and Dubai and places. But if it was recycled back into society, that would be better for everyone. And what I would say to anyone who's thinking about this or has a business is, it's so much more rewarding, you know, I find, having a Philco and then having this side hustle, if you like, where we're supporting all these excellent organizations, than just buying a boat and moving to Monaco or something. You know, if you want to have a legacy and make a difference, do this, because it's really rewarding.
So let's get practical. What's the first step? What's the sort of top piece of advice that you would give to those leaders who want to move their organizations a step closer towards karma capitalism?
Well, read the book, Becky. I mean, it's very short. Listen to it. It's very short, deliberately, because I know entrepreneurs and business people are super busy, and it's very easy to consume the idea and understand it. And then it gives you, the first part of the book is like manifesto, why this is a good idea, which we've been largely discussing. The second half is a how-to guide, really. And there are different types of Philco in terms of how big the shareholdings are and how they might become Philcos. And, you know, every company is different, every entrepreneur is different. But I think it requires a bit of vision at the beginning and a real desire to create a different kind of company that has a real legacy and impact. And if the owners and founders of businesses really want that to be the case in their business, then this is a brilliant way to go. And if someone's starting a business or thinking of starting a business, they can set up in this way at the beginning. And believe me, it's really helped us. It gives us a commercial advantage. This isn't just about giving money to charity, far from it. This is a commercial advantage that is very powerful. And that's why I'm urging people to pick it up and run with it.
James, thank you for being such a brilliant guest on Purposing.
Well, that's very kind of you to invite me, and I hope there'll be many Philcos as a result of your hosting me and people listening. Thanks very much, Becky.
Thanks again to James. Some really interesting ideas there. Here are a few things that I've taken from the conversation. Who owns a business plays a huge role in what gets prioritized and how decisions get made. The Philco idea of putting 10% of shares in a charitable trust seems like a brilliant way to ensure long-term thinking, purpose and sustainability are considered alongside profit and performance. Personally, I don't see philanthropy as an alternative to ESG and sustainability. How you make profit is as important, perhaps even more important than what you do with it. And actually, the best examples in James's book show this. IKEA, Lego, and Patagonia. All businesses that have a powerful purpose, have embedded sustainability into their corporate strategy and cultures, and have foundations that do amazing work to solve big, systemic challenges. For me, this isn't an either-or. It's definitely an and. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you'd like more practical advice on building a purpose-driven business with brilliant insights from people like James, download the Insider's Guide to Purpose at givenagency.com/thinking.